Following the ceremony, John Rourke left. He first returned to New Germany, to his wife, Sarah, to his daughter, Annie, and her husband, Paul. Once again, Dr. Dieter Bern conferred on John the Knight's Cross of New Germany, the country's highest order. Afterwards, John and Dr. Munchen shared a drink.
Herr Doctor, I have been asked by Dieter Bern, but I would myself have asked, to offer you a professorship at the university. You can teach whatever you like, work with our finest doctors, live the life you deserve after all you have endured on mankind's behalf.
Well, thank you, Doctor, but I didn't do anything on mankind's behalf. I did it for me, for my family. Now, the United States needs rebuilding. There's work there I want to do. If I can get the materials and supplies...
A hospital?
Yes.
And what of Commander Dodd, the fellow who wants to be a god or a king?
He's technically the leader of a nation, Eden. He's subject to that nation's laws, and Eden doesn't have any. I intend to correct that.
You? I would have thought...
That law isn't something I'm fond of.
Well...
Munchen smiled, taking a cigarette from his case.
Doctor, would you care for one?
Thank you, no.
Munchen lit his cigarette.
I mean that...
I know what you mean. I mean the Constitution of the United States. We don't need any other laws beyond that, Doctor. There's bound to be an election because Dodd won't have any choice. And the kid or Kurtanami will stand against him.
But you... May I call you John?
Yes, me what?
You could stand against him.
Rourke smiled. He lit one of the thin, dark tobacco cigars he preferred.
No one would ever vote for me. And if anyone would, I wouldn't want it. I'm no politician. Anyone who supposes he's capable of running somebody else's life is a fool or a would-be despot. I'll live my life the way I can and tell no man how to live his. I don't expect the same treatment, but I'll damn well get it.
Then why not stay here, John?
I have to do what I feel is the right thing. You wouldn't do any less, would you? You were never a Nazi. You were always on the side of the people who supported Dieter Bern and freedom, weren't you?
Munchen looked down at the tip of his cigarette, tapped it free of ashes. The tip glowed as he raised it to his lips.
Dodd, if he is working with the neo-Nazis, as you call them, will kill you. You know.
I suspect he'll try.
And what will you do after you have Kurenami elected and your hospital is running perfectly well and Michael is married and Annie and Paul have a child and the baby your wife carries is born? Then what will John Rourke do? Grow old and fat?
Hardly fat. Hopefully old.
After 5 centuries of one life, how do you...
I've never been a violent man, but violence has so often been required of me. Imagine what's out there.
Rourke gestured to the world beyond the cocktail lounge in which they shared a ridiculously small round table.
The pyramids are still standing in Egypt, and I bet in Mexico. Mysteries exist that your science could solve. That mine could never solve. Great underground repositories of books, records, and sound recordings lay in wait for our discovery. Time capsules. Maybe other people. People who somehow managed to survive.
Why are you laughing, John?
Rourke shook his head.
I guess I've always craved adventure. Silly, I mean, I know, but I suppose there's a little boy inside every man. Little boy who wants to find out what's lost and explore things undreamed of.
John Rourke closed his eyes and enjoyed the peace and his dream. Annie Rourke Rubinstein sat with her hands bunched tight in her lap, staring out the window of Wolfgang Mann's private J7V. Mann sent it from New Germany, the former Argentina, before the night of the war, to Lidveldet Island, where Annie and Paul worked to help restore the Hecla community. They flew now to what was once the United States. She felt like she was coming home. Sunrise slowly painted the landscape. Reflections rose from rivers, streams, and lakes, dancing like the sparkle of the diamonds in the little earrings Natalia sometimes wore. The retreat was here, in Georgia, somewhere in the snow-capped mountains below them. She could have found it from an aerial photograph, but the J7V's altitude was too great and its speed too fast for casual observation. Her pre-war home was once near here, too, but down in the Piedmont, not up in the mountains. The house burned the morning after the night of the war. Even its skeletal remains certainly turned to ash when the ionization effect within the atmosphere rose to such a level that fire swept the skies just behind the sunrise. Nearly everything on the surface had burned to cinders.
Home.
But this was home in the physical sense, only partly now in the emotional sense. Annie was no longer a little girl. She was a married woman, and closer to 30 than 20. She and her husband Paul often talked about children, a family. They were planning to try soon. Yet, her father and her mother lived here, near Eden Base, although not in Eden Base proper. And then there was her brother Michael. Michael stayed in New Germany since the war ended, stayed with Maria Leuden. Maria was nice, but not like a sister to her, as was Michael's late wife, Madison.
What you thinking about?
Annie looked at Paul. He moved his hand off the armrest between them, closed it over both of hers in her lap.
Everything.
If I know you, you just realize that all the stuff you packed wasn't enough, and you left the one dress that you really needed at home.
There it was again, that word, home. She smiled, leaning her head against his shoulder.
No, I brought enough.
She was becoming a clothes horse, she realized. After all the years of living just with a brother before the awakening, then being in the field so much with the family, she never had the chance to just be a woman. Now she did, and she enjoyed it. She loved clothes.
What were you thinking about?
Oh, I really was thinking about everything. Sort of. It's only been weeks, really, but it seems like an eternity since we left here.
Well, Makiro and Elaine's wedding makes a good excuse, doesn't it? And you get to be a bridesmaid.
Oh, I hope I don't screw it up. Being a bridesmaid, I mean.
All you have to do is look pretty, right? Honey, you do that just by waking up in the morning.
She squeezed his hand and looked out the window again, trying to see if she could just maybe locate the retreat anyway. The really special thing about any marriage was the fact that two people were pledging their lives and futures to one another. But Sarah Rourke supposed there was something historic to the proceedings as well. Akira Kuranami and Elaine Halverson were the first two people from the Eden Project to return to the surface of the planet after five centuries. Now, Akira and Elaine were being married. Sarah looked at herself in the mirror. Her hair, longer than she had ever worn it before the night of the war, was down, and she felt so fat that she couldn't comfortably do anything else with it.
You don't look like a blimp. You're just pregnant. Except the mirror tells no lies.
She couldn't get into any of the clothes she wore during the war. Her feet were a little swollen, so her shoes felt tight. She couldn't bend over far enough to lace up combat boots if her life depended on it. She'd felt like an idiot, but her toenails needed cutting so badly she was putting holes in her socks. In the end, she asked John to cut them for her.
Oh, baby.
Dr. Rourke started the Pitocin IV at 7 a.m. It was 10, and he was just through with his morning rounds when he heard his beeper kick in. Martha Larimore's face was bathed in sweat, despite what appeared to be valiant efforts on the part of the German nurse.
Dr. Rourke! Oh, thank God!
Relax, you'll be fine.
John looked at the continuous echo sound digital display on the monitor at the head of her bed, positioned just properly so she couldn't see it too. The baby, perfectly formed, moved almost violently within her body. John placed his hand on her abdomen, feeling the baby with his fingertips as he watched the baby boy moving in the birth canal. Rourke looked at the German nurse, a blonde-haired woman somewhere in her 50s, her face stern and her eyes warm.
How many centimeters?
9.5, doctor. And she is better than 95% effaced.
John Rourke nodded.
Wow, you hear that? You'll be delivering in a very little time now. How's your breathing?
She grasped Rourke's hand.
Okay, now I'm gonna go wash up. It won't take long at all. Then I'll be back and we'll help you deliver your baby, okay?
Okay, hurry!
John nodded, checked the echo display again. Despite being premature, the baby was well-formed, large. She was small. This would not be the easiest birth. As he looked at the German nurse, he wrote on the pad at the top of Lieutenant Larimore's chart that she should be given a very mild sedative. Nothing that would put her to sleep, but just enough to relax her so that she could aid in the delivery process, something to take the edge off her near hysteria. Jason Darkwood brushed an imaginary speck from the spit-shined brim of his hat, then looked below them at the ground. Here, there was nothing but radioactive desert. Should the German J-7V in which he, Maggie Barrow, Sam Aldridge, and Sebastian now flew crash, even if they survived the impact, they would never survive the exposure. Parts of the Earth, the scientists said, would be uninhabitable for generations. That thought chilled him. He reached out and took Maggie's hand.
What's the matter, Jace?
Just thinking about something.
What?
Darkwood shrugged his shoulders and smiled.
Well, with what's happened, there's already talk about our people returning to the land, at least in part. But, in a way, haven't we been lucky living under the sea?
Her pretty eyes looked back at him strangely. Beneath his hand, he felt the pressure of the engagement ring he placed on her finger weeks before.
I mean, the sea is clean and fresh, and we could go anywhere except for worrying about the Russians. Now we don't have to worry about them anymore. Every island-class submarine and every missile in their inventory is under our control. They couldn't hurt us if they tried. But here, I don't know, too many memories of what happened, what went before.
Not looking forward to Hawaii?
You've never had to deal with snow, Maggie. It looks great in old videos, and at first it's a novelty, but boy, when you have to work in it day after day, it loses its charm. The oceanographic and atmospheric specialists are saying that it snows at least once a day in the islands.
Maybe we could learn how to ski.
Jason just shook his head, then held her hand tighter. When he looked around the J-7V's cockpit, he could see Sebastian sitting in the co-pilot's seat, learning how to fly the aircraft. Clearly, some of Midwake's citizens would adjust better to the new world than others. The head crowned, and Rourke was astonished, really, at just how well-formed the child was.
You're doing fine, Martha. Just fine.
The mild sedative did the trick for the new mother. Martha was holding her own with the breathing, controlling her pain so well that if John hadn't known better, he would have thought she were having a second or third child rather than a first.
How?
He's healthy looking, Martha.
Rourke eased the first shoulder out.
Okay, now, Martha, I need another good push and we'll have him. Oh, you talk about shoulders. You're going to have to send this boy down to Midwake so he can play football.
Suddenly, the child filled John Rourke's hands. He raised the baby by its heels, and it wasn't even necessary to slap it on the behind.
Is that him? Oh, my God. Is that him?
The German nurse helped, and John Rourke placed the little boy on his mother's arms as he set about to cut the umbilical cord.
Oh, look at him!
The symbolism of what John now did was not lost to him. A cord had been cut for all the world. 5 centuries of war suddenly ended in the total defeat of the enemy. Now, the task of rebuilding, the hardship of reclaiming the land, the challenge of day-to-day life lay before everyone who survived. The headpieces, silly little round things like small crowns worn by the bridesmaids, incorporated a short veil that fell just below eye level. Gazing through the netting, all the world looked to have a pink cast to it, except the flowers. Flowers by the score, flown in from Lidveldet Island, beautiful flowers, unlike anything Natalia had seen since before the night of the war, colored the view. She gazed at a wooden platform, erected with timbers from New Germany, labored over by the small contingent of Midwake Marines she understood were now permanently stationed on the New Germany base beyond the confines of Eden. It looked very much like the deck that overlooked the yard of the small American suburban house she occupied very briefly 5 centuries ago as part of the cover for a mission with Vladimir in the United States. Natalia closed her eyes and listened. She watched Commander Dodd's expression as the etude played. That Dodd came at all was a surprise in itself, because the election that would name the first president of Eden was in progress. Dodd pitted against Akira Kurinami, and Dodd's chances for electoral success dwindled by the moment. Natalia fluffed the skirt of the floor-length pastel pink dress she wore.
There is enough chiffon in this skirt to make one of the German hermetically sealed field tents.
She smiled, picturing a group of German soldiers taking shelter inside a see-through tent colored pink. Annie never did things by half measure, of course, and Annie made all 3 bridesmaids' dresses. Annie's yellow, Sarah's blue. The Presbyterian minister from Midwake, who would read the marriage vows, stood ready. Elaine wore a classically flowing white wedding dress, puff-sleeved and high-necked, with tiers of lace in its skirt. The dress was made for her in New Germany. The tiara that supported her veil was the same one worn by the mother of Midwake's marine captain, Sam Aldridge, for her wedding to Sam's father. Lidvelded Island artists craft the veil of lace. The silk shoes she wore originated in the Chinese Second City. Natalia, Annie beside her, stepped up behind Sarah Rourke as Sarah, Elaine's matron of honor, started down the aisle. A pretty little child from New Germany with ringlets of strawberry blonde hair carried Elaine's train as carefully as if it were made of crystal. Natalia's mind was on everything but doing a good job as a bridesmaid, and there wasn't really that much to do. Just stand there, look pretty, and decorative. She left behind seven classes of eager, scruffy, wonderful children from the wild tribes of Europe, children to whom she taught everything from basic hygiene to basic math, children who taught her that her instinct toward motherhood was alive and well and yearning. But the women from New Germany who aided her at the school would see to the welfare of her precious charges for a while. Construction moved forward on a permanent school. Soviet prisoners of war provided the labor. She dealt with problems of design, procuring materials, and the like. She would be happy when the school was finished, but even happier when the last prisoner was repatriated. That would be several months yet. Natalia was tired, putting in 18 hard hours before boarding the aircraft to Eden. She slept only fitfully on the aircraft. But the time spent was necessary. So much to do to make certain that everything ran smoothly in her absence. It was the thought of seeing John again that drove her, both as an added inducement for traveling back to Georgia and immersing herself in her work even more than usual. For John never left her mind. Now as she looked up, John stepped forward and took Elaine's arm. John looked toward her and their eyes met. She looked down at her dress to control her breathing. In a moment, John would give the bride away, then sit down. Natalia would be standing less than 6 feet from him. As she looked at the little bouquet clutched in her hands, the petals of the flowers trembled. John looked. Natalia had no words to form the thought. There was a little weariness in his eyes, but he looked happy. The uniform of a brigadier general of Midwake's Marines, all the men of the wedding party wore military dress uniforms, became him, although she knew he was uncomfortable wearing it. Sam Aldridge, a very good-looking man, wore the same uniform, more ribbons, less rank, but somehow it didn't look the same on Sam. Dress blue. He looked. She smiled, looking away.
Natalia.
She turned, faced him. John gently touched her upper arms, and his face bent over hers, and she raised her chin. His mouth touched her lips an instant. He held her close for the briefest moment.
You look exquisite.
So do you.
She looked down at her hands. They trembled. Her face felt warm and flushed.
Would you walk with me?
Yes.
He placed her right hand in the crook of his left elbow, and they skirted the edge of the floor full of dancers on their way to a doorway leading to a nearly completed corridor. The room which the wedding, and now the reception, filled would someday be the seat of Eden's new government. It stood now as the only portion of the structure fully completed. Dodd began the complex, but as yet it remained unfinished. They passed Jason Darkwood. He came to attention, bowing slightly to Natalia. Paul and Annie huddled in a corner with Elaine, Akiro, Colonel Mann, and Sarah. At the doorway, John leaned forward, opening a door for her. She passed through, gathering her dress around her, John behind her. The door closed. Natalia felt his hands on her arms, turning her around. She was powerless to say or do anything.
You look well, Natalia.
His brown eyes were so deep, so clear.
You look just tired and happy enough to be enjoying your new hospital.
I am.
She shivered. Was it John, or simply the colder air here?
Here, put this on.
John unbuttoned his uniform jacket, slipped out of it, and draped it around her shoulders. The fabric held the warmth of his body.
Thank you.
She smiled a little at the sight of the butt of the small Smith & Wesson revolver on its Barami hip grip, just to the left of the center of his body. Some things never changed. She drew the coat tight around her. She wanted him to say that he missed her, that he loved her, knew that perhaps he had said it when he told her she looked well.
Damn. Why must I love this man so?
Her world revolved around John since she opened her eyes in the desert after he and Paul found her. Perhaps ever since she saw him the very first time in Latin America when they were agents for opposing countries locked in conflict.
Oh, John, my heart cries a little whenever I see you, and always when you're gone.
I will be leaving sometime tomorrow. They tell me Colonel Mann's personal plane is dropping off Paul and Annie and then flying on to Europe with me.
If you want to teach, soon there'll be children enough here. I just delivered one this morning, a boy.
The first of the Eden children? Premature?
Yeah, but healthy, both mother and son. We managed the birth without a C-section. She was a little afraid, but that's perfectly natural.
Sometimes when she thought about children, her breasts ached. But the only man she ever met, whose children she wanted to bear, was married to one of the two finest women she had ever met.
I am happy it worked out, John. You would like the doctor the Germans have sent us to help with the wild tribe children. A very fine and patient man.
That's marvelous. May I come and see your school sometime?
Oh, I would love that. And the children would love to meet the hero of the war. They talk about you. They like to practice talking every chance they get. And the boys especially. Sometimes they play at war. I don't like it, but all the boys want to be you. You are their hero. But then, you are my hero as well.
John looked embarrassed.
What's so funny?
You and I are very funny, aren't we?
John reached out and held her hands, and if she used all her concentration, maybe she could keep them from trembling, keep herself from swooning like some silly girl in a romantic novel.
You know, I wish I had something fresh to say. Something new that would resolve...
We don't have a problem, John. You live here and I live there. Sarah looks radiant and very pregnant. You are the most fortunate of men.
I know that. At least... sometimes I think I do.
She bit her lower lip, leaned her head against his chest, and he took her into his arms. Natalia felt his breath on her skin and wanted to drown in it. Dodd could not count on support from the neo-Nazis as long as Akira Kurenami stood the better chance of winning election as president of Eden.
I could do away with the election easily enough if it wasn't for that damnable Dr. John Thomas Rourke. His insistent interference in support of outmoded values. You won't see the facts. People aren't fit to govern themselves. The 20th century proved that. It ended in disaster the last time, nearly wiped out all of humanity. I cannot, I will not allow him to take control again under any circumstances.
Commander Christopher Ignatius Dodd sat at the command console of Eden 1, hands on the armrests of his command chair, his eyes peering at his own image reflected there in the windshield against the stormy dark, the command compartment surrounding him. The effect was like that of a beacon in the night. He would be that beacon to the true people.
I saw it all 5 centuries ago. I learned the truth then. The weakness in the United States grew out of racial inferiors inbreeding with the Aryan people. Now, I'm a taxi driver supreme to the racial inferiors, helping the mongrels to return to Earth to destroy it again. And their hero, John Rourke, is determined to make it happen. My God! He allowed his only daughter, a beautiful white woman, to marry the Jew Rubinstein. And Rubinstein now plants his degenerate seed, leading to another destruction of the United States. Rourke. Man all but single-handedly toppled the government of New Germany, giving the weakling, short-sighted, fringe members of that glorious society their so-called democracy. He deposed a man whose very essence defined Aryan superiority, defined Aryan deity. As long as Rourke survives to support the Japanese, who just married the black, the mongrelization of the new Earth will spread unabated. That yellow slowpick can fuck a black woman by sanction of a pseudo-religion as much as he wants. But that they should live to threaten the order mankind so desperately needs, that is an abomination against nature. I will not let them deny what I deserve, the leadership I deserve. I have served too long. I am so much more able. It is the will of divine providence. I will not be denied. Without my leadership and courage, not a single one of the shuttle fleet that launched on the night of the war, that traveled in cryogenic suspension to the edge of the solar system and back, not a single vessel of the fleet would have returned. No one would have survived. Not even John Rourke or Akira Kuranami can dispute that. But how quickly they forget. All because of Rourke. How quickly they forget I gave life to the planet. Midwake, with its blacks and Jews and Orientals and mongrelized so-called whites, is not a fit starting place for life. Nor were either of the Soviet enclaves, on land or beneath the sea. Only New Germany held hope, held a chance for humanity. But now, thanks to Rourke, with Rourke out of the way, I can eliminate Kuranami. No one would be the wiser. I can step in, lead, weed out the racial inferiors, and bring about a new order on this reborn Earth. The Russians are powerless now. Eventually, the Russian Slavs and other racial inferiors will be dealt with. The new power will grow, with Eden its center of energy, and New Germany its logical convert. But first, that damn Rourke, strutting about in his midwake brigadier general's uniform, courting the communist bitch Chernorovna before the very eyes of his pregnant wife. Sarah Rourke is strong too. If I can liquidate her as well, all the better. The Jew Rubinstein would protest, would accuse, but I can deal with him like any Jew. The key is John Rourke. Tonight, that key will turn forever.
Sarah Rourke felt like a giant blue Easter egg, and standing still hurt her back more than walking. So, with her lined German field jacket over the bridesmaid's dress she wore, she walked alone along the single street between the shelters erected by the Eden Project crew. She slipped out of the reception, then slipped out of her Chinese shoes into her combat boots. She looked down at herself.
Oh, I may feel like a giant blue Easter egg, but I look like a fat man in drag. Whew.
It was cold. Sarah understood the symbolic meaning of Akira's and Elaine's wedding taking place in Eden, but it would have been a vastly more comfortable affair had it been held at the recently restored and expanded German base just outside Eden. The heat was better, and so were the washrooms. Pregnant women became connoisseurs of toilet facilities.
Eden. Perhaps history does repeat itself. Perhaps the snake in the garden is less literal than figurative. A logical candidate for snake slithers around here. But if this dreary place is Eden, I don't know why Adam and Eve felt discouraged to be tossed out on their ear. A hell in the making here, perhaps. This sure isn't Eden.
Of course, neither she nor John could vote, because neither of them was an Eden Project survivor. About 100 people, all the survivors remaining from the Eden Project, and only they, would determine what would certainly be the future of the United States. Someday, perhaps, the destiny of this new world. She actually heard one of the Eden survivors, someone logic and common sense would dictate to be too intelligent to harbor such thoughts, murmuring under his breath, "Think of the children." As Akira, a Japanese, married Elaine, an African-American.
You betcha you ought to think of the children. With brilliant and courageous parents who will love and nurture them, teach them, respect them, prepare them to make this new world a better place than the old one? Think of the children of the man who made that remark, growing up to inherit a father's mindless bigotry.
Sarah dug her hands into the jacket's muff pockets and walked toward her husband's hospital, where, in a short while, she would deliver the baby she carried. John smoked one of Natalia's cigarettes, sitting beside her. He was a little cold, but Natalia needed his jacket, so he dismissed the cold, smoked the cigarette. He felt the pressures of his love for Natalia and his love for his pregnant wife, Sarah. Natalia leaned her pretty head against his shoulder.
Do you think there is anything to what the Hindus believed?
He just looked at her, not quite taking her meaning, as her words pulled him from his own thoughts.
That perhaps in another life we...
Transmigration of souls? I don't know. I long ago taught myself to discount no theory until thoroughly disproven, so I won't discount the possibility. Why?
Men are amazing.
Ooh, I don't think that was a compliment.
It wasn't, John. Why would I be thinking about another life instead of this one?
He thought that he might suspect an answer, but it would be such a terribly conceited-sounding thing to say.
Men can be so emotionally obtuse at times, it is hard to comprehend. I meant that if there is another life in store for us, I hope that then, maybe, we will be able to be together. This life is no longer a viable proposition.
I'm sorry for what I've done.
No, John. There is nothing you should be sorry for. And the only person whose fault any of this is mine.
The fault, dear Brutus, lies not in our stars, but in ourselves.
Though he spoke of the stars, they were unable to see any stars through the doors at the end of this cold and dark corridor.
Julius Caesar?
Yeah.
You used to watch the stars a lot, John. On those nights out in the desert. What were you thinking?
Rourke extinguished his cigarette beneath his heel and held Natalia's right hand in both of his.
I was trying to convince myself that there was something better out there. I didn't know about the Eden Project then, and I wouldn't exactly say we've been touched by the finger of God in their return.
Are you that much of a cynic, or only on certain subjects?
Only on certain subjects. For example, I think the New York Stock Exchange will never rebound.
Be serious, John.
Well, as an ex-communist, you should be familiar with the cyclical view of history.
And?
Well, I sometimes wonder if we came in at the end of one cycle and lived through into the next.
Do you think that years from now, two people like us will sit here having this same conversation, John?
Maybe. Or maybe two people already did.
Natalia hugged his left arm very tightly.
Would you tell me that you love me just one more time?
He looked at her, touched his fingertips to her chin, and raised her face.
I love you now, and will always love you. But please, find a way to stop loving me.
If I love you? That's a logical absurdity, just like it would be to stop loving you.
John Rourke kissed Natalia Tiamarovna.
I will never kiss her like this again.
He hoped what he was thinking would be wrong. Natalia pushed open one of the two exterior doors, passed through the foyer, then the inside doorway.
Oh, heat.
There wasn't enough warmth that she was tempted to remove her coat. She just let it fall open. The coat was a relic of her past, and in that respect, she detested it. But it was both warm and beautiful. For those reasons, she could rationalize keeping it. Russian sable, the very best, ankle length, full enough that she could almost wrap it around her body twice. She could have been wearing her double-holster rig with the stainless L-frame 357 Magnum revolvers beneath it, and no one looking at her would have been the wiser. The shawl she threw over her head against the biting wind, she now tugged down to her shoulders. Her hands were warm enough in her gloves, but her toes were stiff with the cold. Chinese silk shoes were terribly ill-suited for the near-Arctic conditions here in American Georgia. She had never been inside this hospital of John's, and she stood now just inside the inner doorway, looking around.
May I assist you, Fräulein?
Natalia looked toward the desk at the far side of the hallway. Beneath the desk lamp's light, she could see a woman's face, plain but with a pleasant smile.
You must be Magda.
Yes, Fräulein, but...
John, Dr. Rourke, I mean. He said you might know where his wife was.
She's in her husband's office. I can show you.
It's Fräulein Tiamarovna, Natalia. And if you'll just point the way for me, I'm certain I'll be all right.
Right down this corridor on the right. You'll see his name on the door.
Thank you so much. John has told me so many wonderful things about you. It's a pleasure to finally meet you.
Thank you. The pleasure's all mine. And you know, of course, the good doctor exaggerates from time to time.
Natalia headed for John's office. There were lights burning inside as Natalia knocked.
Come in.
Natalia entered and saw Sarah behind John's desk, sitting there with a .45 in her right hand.
Hi.
Sarah smiled, lowered the pistol to the desk as Natalia closed the door behind her.
Sorry.
You're like John, still carrying a gun.
Sarah shrugged her shoulders under a German Arctic parka.
Aren't you?
Natalia moved her left leg forward, then lifted her dress, revealing the Walther PPKS, sans its usual suppressor, in the black fabric Galco thigh holster. As she let her clothes fall back in place, she gestured to the small beaded bag she carried.
My Bali song. I guess old habits.
Not just old habits. John hasn't been elaborating on what's going on here, has he?
Natalia sat down opposite Sarah.
What do you mean? I know that the election between Dodd and Akiro is...
Bitter? Maybe that's too mild a word. John refuses to take it seriously. But I think Dodd sees John as a threat and wouldn't stop at trying to kill him.
That is the reason for the gun, then. No. John said nothing about things being that bad.
Sarah turned the gun around on the desk blotter.
He thinks I'm being a worrier. Maybe I am.
Sarah smiled, still looking at the gun.
Funny. Before the night of the war, I wouldn't touch a gun, except to move it so I could dust. Oh, God, how things change us.
Maybe events merely awaken us to necessity. Will it bother you if I smoke?
No, so long as it's not one of John's cigars. Ugh.
Natalia took cigarettes and lighter from her purse and fired the lighter. She looked at Sarah.
How are you feeling?
Fat.
Natalia was momentarily taken aback.
You remember Michael and Annie when they were little? You should have seen me when I was carrying Michael. He weighed 9 1/4 pounds at birth. Oh, I looked like the Goodyear blimp. I don't think this little guy's going to be as big.
Then it will...
Oh, amniocentesis? Me? A needle in my navel?
Natalia remembered the reason she came.
Akiro and Elaine will be getting picked up in a little while. John wanted to know if you'd like to come and see them off.
Oh, sure, but my back was killing me, just standing. Not used to even a little heel like these things anymore.
Ooh. Sarah gestured to her shoes as she stood up. They moved along the street now, walking side by side. Natalia walking more slowly than she would have liked, but terrified that Sarah would slip on the icy road surface and fall and hurt herself or the baby.
Ever heard of the acronym DREAD?
Yes. I assumed it was just disinformation.
John said he assumed the same. By the way, thanks for being a friend. Especially now.
What do you mean?
Natalia huddled her shoulders deeper into her coat, her feet quickly chilled. But it wasn't that far a walk to the Eden headquarters, so she told herself her toes would be fine.
What do you mean?
About which?
Being your friend. I mean, I think we are friends.
I mean, with John. Now, then, he's a strong man, but he could have been pushed. Did you see a lot of American movies?
Everyone I could. I had to pretend to be American often enough, and they helped a lot.
Ever notice, with rare exceptions, of course, women were never shown to be buddies?
You and I should have been fighting over him?
Yes, scratching each other's eyes out and all that sort of dumb stuff.
I couldn't see either of us doing that.
But if we were really buddies, just like guys, we would have flipped a coin over him and let the best man win.
I suppose. I don't know. You are the best man and you won already. I am happy for you both. So then, what did you hear about Dredd?
I can't see how you ever passed the spy school course in lying, Natalia. Because you are terrible at it. But you're nice to try.
Sarah reached out and took Natalia's hand in hers.
You are a good friend.
Natalia leaned forward and kissed Sarah's cheek, very cold from the wind, but that didn't matter. They held each other for a long, quiet moment. The wind rose as one of the German helicopters from the base just outside Eden arrived. Natalia stabbed her already gloved hands into the pockets of her coat, drawing the garment more tightly around her. She pushed her knees together more tightly as the helicopter's downdraft ricocheted off the landing pad and the icy wind blew up under her dress. Natalia smiled, thinking how interesting it would have been if someone had thought to invoke the old American custom of tying tin cans, had there been any, to the wedding car, the helicopter. But, of course, the honeymoon was to be a little out of the ordinary, too. No Niagara Falls. Instead, a quick flight to the German base, then by J-7V to the floating landing field the Germans recently built over Midway. Natalia understood John offered them the retreat, but advised them against its use. The only true getaway would be Midway, because it was the only place on Earth with totally controlled access. It was also where Akira arranged to store the duplicate computer files from the Eden Project. While the two honeymooned, Akira would search the duplicate Eden computer files for any information about Dread. Natalia recalled Dread well, the acronym somehow more chilling than the cold surrounding her. Defense Recovery Emergency Armed Deterrent. It was an arsenal of nuclear weapons put away for the proverbial rainy day. And John, according to Sarah, felt that Commander Dodd wanted it under his control. The man would have to be insane. Natalia felt movement beside her. It was John, one arm around Sarah, the other around her. She huddled close against him, and when she saw Sarah's face, Sarah smiled.
Here they come!
Akira and Elaine with an Arctic parka over her wedding dress, emerged from the complex, waving at their friends. Though Elaine's bouquet sailed toward her, Natalia didn't even try. Young Martha Larimer was having trouble. Her child wasn't taking to her breast. Sarah and Natalia flanked John as he walked along the street toward the hospital, considering the old aphorism about a rose between two thorns. In reality, it never seemed to work that way. Tonight, he was indeed the thorn between two roses.
You, Natalia, are not getting off without being around here after the baby comes. You're just going to have to make time. And John and I have already decided, if you don't mind, that if we have a girl, well, we want to name her after you.
Oh, Sarah, you don't have to.
We want to. And you'd better get used to the idea that, boy or girl, you'll be Aunt Natalia.
I've never been an aunt before.
I'm not a thorn between two roses. I'm a net on a ping pong table.
He stopped trying to look from one woman to the other to follow the conversation, merely looked straight ahead toward the hospital.
I don't know why, but I can't remember the last time I felt so happy.
At least he would still have Natalia as his friend, and Sarah and Natalia seemed better friends than ever. That was good. Soon Akira would know if the Dread weapon system was a reality and something Dodd might realistically obtain. And the election would come, and Akira, respected by almost everyone, would surely win the presidency. The only potential for war now was Miner, the still-surviving neo-Nazi group headquartered somewhere in the remote regions of what had been Paraguay. German long-range mountain patrol units searched for them even now, and it was only a matter of time before they were captured or killed. Annie and Paul were building a life together and helping Madame Yokley to rebuild the Hecla community in Lidveldet Island.
God's in heaven and all's right with the world.
The two women he loved just looked at him. A knock came at the hatchway of the shuttle. Commander Christopher Dodd took the Beretta pistol from the console near his hand, stood up and walked to the hatchway lock, twisted it open with one hand, and stepped back as the hatch moved. In the doorway stood a solitary man, face obscured by snow goggles and a toque. The hood of his parka snorkeled close. He was a big man, his powerful build apparent despite the Arctic gear. In his lightly gloved right hand was a semi-automatic pistol.
Herr Commander Dodd, I am Dietrich.
Dodd waited for the Latin code phrase.
Alea jacta est.
Dodd knew its English translation well, the words Julius Caesar supposedly uttered when, against orders, he prepared to cross the Rubicon River with his army. The die is cast. Dodd lowered his weapon.
Your baby is lovely. Oh, and he's so well-developed.
Martha smiled, touching the child's face with her fingertips.
Isn't he beautiful?
Now it's your turn to keep your fingers crossed for me.
Natalia looked at Martha Larimer and then at Sarah. Lieutenant Larimer put her baby to her breast again. The advice John gave her had helped, and the baby seemed to be feeding well now. Natalia felt a wave of regret wash over her. The more she thought of it, the more she wanted a baby. But it would have to be John's baby, and that could never be. She sometimes pictured herself holding such a child, nursing it, loving it, watching it grow to adulthood in John's image. Though she tried to keep them from her heart, the thoughts always found a way back in. Michael Rourke began to undress.
Wasn't she a beautiful bride, Michael?
Yes, Elaine was very beautiful.
Michael turned around to face Maria, already in her nightgown, sitting on the edge of the bed in the guest officer's quarters.
Would you like to get married?
Michael?
Will you marry me?
Oh!
She ran from the bed into his arms, and he held her against his bare body. He didn't love her, but she loved him, and he liked her so very much. He knew the difference. He loved Madison, always would. And Michael was convinced that true love came only once in a lifetime, at least for him. John inspected the medical imaging results from the examination of Sergeant Riemenschneider once again. Rourke could try the therapy here, of course, but the cancer was too far along to take any risks. Midwake's medical staff could accomplish the therapy in their sleep. He began the memo to the German base commander, recommending the sergeant, a likable old guy if ever there was one, and very close to his retirement, be flown at once to Midwake for treatment. Many types of cancer, especially in the early stages, could be instantly and permanently eradicated with drugs developed in Midwake, now available to all the Allies and their former enemies. But some, like pancreatic cancer, always tricky, required specialized implant techniques. To accomplish these in a normally equipped hospital meant major surgery, but the time-release drugs could be inserted through special appliances at Midwake, where the medical imaging equipment was vastly advanced over anything possessed even by the Germans in their most advanced facilities. After a few days in the hospital at Midwake, the sergeant's condition would be vastly improved. In a few weeks, he would be in total remission, the damage already done by the disease undone through the miracle of Midwake's gene-splicing technology.
All right, that'll do.
Rourke looked at the Rolex on his left wrist.
Holy mackerel, 1 a.m., I gotta get some sleep.
Annie sat bolt upright in bed.
Annie, what's wrong?
Annie's nightgown was wet with perspiration. Paul didn't turn on a light, but could see her well enough in the faint light through the windows of the officer's quarter billet. His right hand went to her thigh, his left hand to the Browning high power on the floor beside their bed.
What is it? What's wrong, baby?
It's Mama and Daddy. They're in terrible trouble.
He sat there in the darkness beside her, collecting his thoughts for an instant longer. Annie Rourke Rubenstein, ever since the awakening, possessed what some would call a gift and others would call a curse. At a library in Germany, on a video fiche of an old English language book, he discovered the proper term for it, remote viewing, as distinguished from clairvoyance. She could not see the future, but she could see the present, wherever she was, if it somehow affected someone she loved. Paul swung his feet over the edge of the bed, grabbed his pants from the chair nearby, and pulled them on.
Honey, get some clothes on.
Maybe things had been quiet too long for the family. For the first time since the war against the Russians ended, the entire family, John and Sarah, Natalia, Michael, Annie, and himself, were together. Ever since childhood, when he heard the stories of how Hitler guided his armies by astrological projections, he rejected the idea that there was any such thing as fate. But if there was, it was at work here tonight. Fate.
I love you, Michael.
Michael and Maria lay entwined in one another's arms, their passion resolved in contented quiet. Michael stared at the phone. He reached across Maria and picked up the phone.
This is Michael Rourke.
It's me, Annie. Mom and Daddy are in trouble. We're going to the hospital. They aren't at their quarters, and Paul tried calling the hospital. Either they're talking to somebody, or the terminal has been disconnected or something. They set it up so it thinks it's talking to itself, and nothing gets through, but it gives the caller a busy signal. I'm on my way. You guys be careful.
Michael hung up the phone and got out of bed.
What is it, Michael?
There might be a problem with Mom and Dad. You stay put and lock the door after me.
Michael knew better than to ask if Paul or Annie called the authorities. The hospital was under the jurisdiction of Eden. If there was a problem, the current leader of Eden would be behind it. Michael also knew better than to ask Maria to accompany him. She would have, as the expression went, followed him into hell. But when they got there, she wouldn't have been much help, despite her loyalty, sincerity, and desire to try. She was a wonderful, intelligent, and talented woman, but in the ways of violence, no amount of desire could compensate for her lack of abilities. Still, there was something she could do.
Call Colonel Mann. Give me about 5 minutes, and then tell him to think up some pretext for entering Eden.
His sister's psychic flashes proved annoyingly accurate. Natalia swept up the pink chiffon and silk that was the skirt of her bridesmaid's dress and grabbed the Walther PPKS in the black fabric Galco thigh holster. The little stainless 380 pistol in her hand, her right thumb worked the slide-mounted thumb safety up and off. She stood stock still, waiting. Her little gun was loaded with German-fabricated duplicates of the Federal 90-grain jacketed hollow-point load she used in the gun ever since the first day she took it out of its black plastic box. Not long after that, she got the barrel threaded to accept a suppressor. The suppressor, along with the shoulder holster in which she so frequently carried the Walther, lay in her suitcase, back at the bachelor officer's quarters at the German base outside Eden. If she used the gun, she couldn't help but wake up some of John's patients. She listened for the sound to come again. The medium heel shoes she wore had hard heels and would click as she walked. She stepped out of them. The hem of her dress tumbled over her toes. The gun in her right hand, her dress pinched between the thumb and first finger of her left hand, Natalia started toward the windows across the cold floor of the corridor. Young Lieutenant Larimar's baby had started spitting up, and although John thought nothing was wrong, to humor an anxious first-time mother, he agreed to examine the baby in greater detail and observe the child until it was asleep. John's problem as a physician was exactly the same as his trouble during the war. Dr. Rourke could not remain uninvolved or uncaring. His problem was also his greatest virtue. Natalia peered through the windows into the swirling snow of the night. She saw nothing but her own reflection against the work light over the reception desk, well down the corridor. The trouble with a hospital or hotel or motel or any similar facility was the multiplicity of doors behind which someone could hide. She walked along the corridor. A door opened to her right, and she wheeled toward it, realizing instantly that she had made a fatal error when she heard the sound of another door opening behind her. Natalia recognized the smell immediately, the classic scent of bitter almonds, cyanide. Automatically, Natalia turned her face away from the cloud of gas that billowed toward her from the doorway and pulled the trigger of her pistol. She collapsed to the floor. Having used a cyanide gas pistol enough herself in the days prior to the night of the war, she knew she was a dead woman. Munchen lifted the receiver of his telephone, automatically opened his case, and pulled one of the custom-blend non-carcinogenic cigarettes.
This is Munchen.
This is Colonel Mann here, Doctor. I may need you. Bring your bag and your pistol. A corporal will be in to collect you in a moment.
What the?
John Rourke looked away from the baby as he wheeled toward the doorway. The Centennial came into his hand from the waistband of his uniform trousers in the same motion. It was clearly the sound of a pistol shot, nothing else. Suddenly, her husband's little office was a very vulnerable place, with too many windows, no secure door, very little potential for covered positions from which to return fire. Sarah groped for the Trapper Scorpion 45 in the pocket of her German Arctic parka draped over the back of her husband's chair. The pistol's chamber was already loaded, and she thumbed back the hammer as she stood. Pain shot through her from groin to chest. It was cold and hot at once. Fluid burst from her, spraying down between her legs and onto the floor. As her water broke, her knees went weak. As she upped the safety on the 45 and doubled forward over the desk, she knew the baby was coming early.